This is Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tonight's subject, the Arabs live there too. Tonight's guest, Middle East expert Alfred Lilienthal. Night Call is your program. Share your opinions and ideas with the rest of the country. Speak for yourself and ask your questions directly by calling Night Call in New York City from anywhere in North America. Here are Night Call's special phone numbers. From the East and Midwest, call collect at area code 212-749-3311. From the West at 212-749-3357. And from the New York area at 866-5010. And now from New York City, Night Call's host, Del Shields.
Good evening. The question, has Israel a right to exist, seems no longer to be the point, even though that existence is challenged by the Arab question. Did Israel build its house on another man's grave? A much more realistic question would be, what kind of Israel has a right to exist? And can any kind of Israel survive if it is not aggressive? Yet, can the rights of the Arabs survive if Israel is aggressive, expansionist, and militant? The problem, of course, is not nations. It is people. Both Arab and Jew has human rights that must be recognized. And the fact remains, there are some 1.5 million Arab refugees. They are a tragedy as human beings. They are a constant reminder of failure and humiliation. To the Arab nations, they are a living memory of an injustice done and not redressed. Where does the Arab refugee belong? Are they a new world group without identity, a people like the Jews once were, without a nation, without a piece of land to call their own? These are questions for Night Call's guest, Mr. Alfred Lilienthal, who is standing by in New York City. Mr. Lilienthal is editor of Perspective, lecturer on the Middle East, and author of the book, The Other Side of the Coin. Mr. Lilienthal, good evening. Thank you for being with us.
Nice to be here.
Mr. Lilienthal, you have said that if there's a World War III, it will start in the Middle East. Why, sir?
Well, I believe that the tremendous importance of this area, with its teeming millions, with its strategic position, with the 72% of the oil reserves, means that the United States would never yield the area to the Soviet Union and or Red China, and that the big powers are now struggling to increase their sphere of influence in it. And I don't think that such a conflagration will come over Vietnam. It might come over the Middle East, where the Soviet Union has made tremendous advances in terms of affluence and influence in the area.
What were your feelings on the Israeli peace proposal, which was presented by Abba Ibn today to the UN?
I don't think that the peace proposal advanced by Mr. Ibn heads an awful lot, despite the glowing headlines in the New York Times and other of the media who are very favorable to the position of the State of Israel. The important thing is an acceptance of the two basic principles set down in the resolution of November 22nd. The first one, calling for withdrawal of forces based upon what the United Nations calls the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war, and the second one, the termination of all claims of belligerency. The big problem is that Israel seems to repeat again, if you recognize us, you Arab countries, we will withdraw. And the Arab countries seem to say, we will only recognize you if you withdraw first. These things are supposed to be done simultaneously, and yet the very basis of the Security Council resolution lays greater emphasis on the question of withdrawal. The IBAN proposal talks about first arriving at recognized boundaries, and then there will be, quote, a disposition of forces to be carried out in full accordance with the boundaries under the final peace. end of quote, and whatever that means, it certainly doesn't mean the kind of withdrawal which was envisioned in the resolution. Now, the door is open. There is a possibility. Mr. Eban said that he would talk with Ambassador Yaring, that in such indirect talks, he may spell out the specifics of what he hinted at in his talk. But on the basis of the address to the General Assembly, there really is nothing terribly new. There's a hope, a very dim hope.
Mr. Lilienthal, we're going to take our first question as the Night Call listeners are beginning to call in. And we want to take a moment out first to remind our Night Call listeners that in New York, our telephone number is 866-5010. And if you're calling from the East or the Midwest, it's area code 212-749-3311. That's area code 212-749-3311. On the West Coast, it's area code 212-749-3357. Remember, we welcome your calls collect, and tonight our conversation, the Arabs live there too. Our guest is Mr. Alfred Lilienthal, a Middle East expert, and we'll take our first call from Mrs. Meyer, who is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM. Mrs. Meyer, good evening.
Good evening, and the name is Mayer.
Mayer, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Thank you.
Good evening, Mr. Lilienthal.
Good evening, Mrs. Mayer.
I'd like to ask you, in line with what you are saying, do you think that the press in the United States is slanted? Do you think we get a fair picture from our press here in America?
The answer would be very, very definitely no. The American press has continuously given the American people just one side of the story, both in my newsletter Perspective, where we have a whole section which we call misinformation. I detail the instances in which radio, television, newspapers, and most recently magazines such as Look magazine, in its Ira Hirschman piece on the refugees, continually slant and distort the truth. Their motivation sometimes is advertising, sometimes pressure. Sometimes they feel, as an eminent New York Times correspondent once said, I can't face my Jewish friends if I say too many nice things about the Arabs. For whatever reason, it becomes impossible to get the story before the American people of the fact that there are two sides to this case, that the Arabs have a case, the Israelis have a case, and one would never know it from reading the New York Times, Look magazine, or other important media.
Sure. Well, this is the first I had heard of the magazine that you put out, Perspective, and I'd like very much to find out more about that, and I imagine others would, too. Could you tell me more about that?
Well, it's a monthly newsletter in which we try to bring the story behind the story, both through detailed articles which we receive from correspondents in the Middle East, through news items that you can't read generally in the press, and generally to show how the American national interest, on which our policy must be based, is being neglected because of fear, pressure, misinformation. And we try to shed a little light, and I think if you would write us, we'd be happy to send you a sample copy.
Well, I'm certainly
plug,
going to
plug,
do that.
Plug, plug, plug.
Well, thank you very much, and much good luck to you in the work you're doing.
Thank you for your telephone call.
Thank you, sir. Goodbye.
Thank you for calling. We'll take our next call from Flint, Michigan. Mr. Dean is hearing Night Call over WMRP. Mr. Dean? I'm sorry, Mr. Dean has left. All right, getting back to our guest now, Mr. Lilienthal, I'll remind you once again of our phone numbers, 866-5010, area code 212-749-3311, and on the West Coast, it's area code 212-749-3357. Mr. Lilienthal, what kind of Israel can exist at this present time, and what kind of Israel can exist when we have to think in terms of 1.5 million Arab refugees? Just how do we resolve this kind of problem?
Well, the kind of an Israel that can exist is a de-Zionized Israel. You'd be amused, Al, that the first time I made this proposal in 1957 before the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, The next day, one of the papers said Lilienthal calls for a de-zoned Israel. A de-Zionized Israel is an Israel that would become a normal state, would give up this idea of ingathering of Jews all over the world, would cut its umbilical ties with world Jewry, and would permit Arabs to return home, to have a binational state in which Arab and Jews, as they did traditionally for hundreds of years before Zionism reared its ugly head, could live together. Incidentally, I had the pleasure just 3-4 days ago sitting for several hours with Uri Avnari, who sits in the Israeli Knesset, is a member of a small party there, and he has just authored a book called Israel Without Zionists. So that there is a small percentage of people within Israel itself that envisions a de-Zionized Israel. That is the only hope of bringing together a peaceful, harmonious relationship. This would take a long time, but it is Zionism that is the obstacle. It is not any ancient animosity, as the Republican platform mistakenly noted, and the Democrats have done the same thing. No ancient animosity between Arab and Jew that stands in the way. The Arabs always welcomed Jews down through history. This is not anti-Semitism of the Hitlerian sort. This is a head-on clash between two rising nationalism, Arab nationalism on the one hand, and Israeli nationalism or Zionism on the other, that have met in the one place which they both claim as their own. And bigotry and discrimination, if it does appear, will only be the result of the 1967 war and the horrors that followed it, rather than the motivation behind this animosity. So a de-Zionized, a normalized Israel, a binational Israel, an Israel which was envisioned originally by Martin Buber, Judah Magnus, Albert Einstein, and others, might be the hope for the future.
How is it possible that, as you say, to cut the umbilical cord between Israel and the world Jewry and still have an Israel?
Oh, the Israel then would take its place as a Middle Eastern state, a binational, call it by whatever name, with the Arab world, with which it must become a part of, rather than to be viewed and to serve as a tool of Western influence and Western power. It would rely on trade rather than aid, on friendship, and being part of the Middle East, where it happens to be physically, where 60% of its own Jewish population is now made up of Oriental Jews. It would look into its own hemisphere, and this is the future, not being propped up by outside aid, by support financially, even though no one can question its military might for a number of years can protect it.
Let us assume that such a federation or such a combination of compatible Arabs and compatible Israelis can get together and develop a nation. But what happens to Jewry as a philosophy, or what happens to it as a religion? What happens to whatever it is that has kept the entire Jewish world together as it is today, or as we know it?
Well, the Israel is hardly a bastion of Judaism. It may be a bastion of armed Israeli might, but religion within the state is not the Judaism. Religion is the state itself. And believe it or not, there is a strong trend towards atheism, agnosticism, and within Israel, religion is frowned upon. Mr. Avnari makes this point in his book, and others who have been there on my previous visit there, I noticed this too. There's no question that Judaism does not depend upon a political state. As a matter of fact, those who talked about the someday there might be a recreation of Israel, the use of the word Israel was in the spiritual terms, that day on which man would beat his swords into plowshares, and all men would look with courage into each other's eyes and say, brother, shalom or salam, whichever we use, the Arabic or the Hebrew. But there is nothing religious about the state of Israel, save the fact that there is a strong orthodoxy, which amounts to about 6% of the state, which runs the private lives, marriage, intestacy, divorce, but has no influence other than a political influence by being in the cabinet. I mean, no influence with the masses.
Mr. Lilienthal, we must break for station identification. Then we'll be coming right back, and we have calls standing by in Michigan as well as New Jersey. This is the Night Call Network. Stay tuned.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Alfred Lilienthal after station identification. In our city and our state and all across the United States, people are talking about trouble in our nation. Black and white trouble. Some people speak of racial tension. Some say poverty is the real problem. Some say law and order is giving way to anarchy in our streets. About the only thing on which most people agree is that there is a crisis and that we are a people with many unanswered questions. This station believes that you deserve to ask your own questions and get some answers, or at least opinions, from some people who should know what they're talking about. And so we bring you Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show where the public asks their questions and expresses their opinions to guest experts like Julian Bond, John Lindsay, Roy Innes, Joan Baez, and Godfrey Cambridge. Night Call, the nationwide radio forum on important issues facing you and the rest of the nation, each weeknight on this station. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself, collect, from anywhere in the country to Alfred Lilienthal about the Middle East. Call Night Call Collect from the East and the Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And we return to our guest, Mr. Alfred Lilienthal, who's calling in from New York City, and this time we'll go out to Flint, Michigan. Mr. Dean, whom we missed in the first quarter hour, is back with us, and he's calling in from WMRP. Mr. Dean?
Good evening, Doug.
Good evening, sir.
I have a question for Mr. Lilienthal concerning today's news. The President administration gave the Department of State, as we know, an authorization to go ahead to sell 50 Phantom jets to Israel, and I just wondered if Mr. Lilienthal would make a comment on that.
Well, I'm happy to make a comment, particularly to my friends in Flint, where I lectured last November. And I think the question came up at that time in a little different context, and my answer is still the same. I don't think we're going to solve the Middle East problem by engaging in an arms race. And the more we arm Israel, the more the Soviet Union will send arms into Iraq, Syria, Algeria, and Jordan. Awful circle of events that have been taking place will continue. I would rather hope that our purpose would be to try to approach the Soviet Union and get a de-escalation of arms rather than to heighten the arms race. And Israel seems to have a superiority already, which is due to our efforts. So I can't see, not only will it not help the general picture of restoring stability to the area, but it will further cause the continued move of this Arab world, which wants friendship with the United States, towards the Soviet camp.
I see. Then you do think that the Soviet Union would retaliate this move?
I'm sure that this is will follow as it has in the past. I don't think sending arms to Israel 1 minute and then sending arms to Jordan and then creating a new potential situation as we did in 1967 when American tanks in the hands of the Israelis met American tanks in the hands of the Jordanians in mortal combat. I think this is the height of folly and will only lead to more of what we've been having. War and the further retrogression and the growing influence of the Soviet Union in that part of the world.
I see. Well, thank you very much, sir, and come back and see us in Flint soon.
I'd love to.
Thank you, Dell.
Thank you for calling, sir. This is Night Call in New York, and tonight our guest is Mr. Alfred Lilienthal, and he's calling in from New York City, and tonight we're discussing the Arabs live there, too. Our discussion, of course, on the Middle East. This time to New Jersey. Mr. Mayassi is hearing Night Call over WLIB. Good evening, sir.
Good evening, Mr. Lilienthal.
Good evening.
I would like to hear your comments on the article that was that appeared in the Look magazine last month by Mr. Hirschman concerning the Palestinian refugees, which I feel really it gave a distorted picture.
Well, I think you've in part summed it up. The Look article by Ira Hirschman contained so many errors and distortions that the United Nations Relief Works Agency, through their director in New York, issued a statement in the press. As you know from reading the article, Mr. Hirschman implied that many of the refugees did not exist. The United Nations Relief Works Agency, which administers the aid there, replied by saying that the 180,000 children who attend our schools every day certainly exist. So do the 3,300 students in UNWAR's Centers for Vocational and Teacher Training. UNWAR has also verified the existence of 57,000 students who are given some financial help in government and private schools. The letter goes on to point out that the refugees who make a total of 6 million visits each year to UNWAR health clinics also exist, and so do 113,000 children who drink a glass of UNWAR milk daily. In addition to the protest by UNWAR, the former director general, Dr. Davis, in a letter to the editor of Look, which as yet has not appeared, pointed out that Mr. Hirschman had gone to the area on his own and in no way connected without remuneration from UNWAR. And even the State Department was brought into the picture when the Assistant Secretary of State, Lucius D. Battle, in a statement to Dr. Mehdi of the Action Committee, said that Ira Hirschman, whatever views he presented in his article, did it on his own and did not represent the position of the State Department. Throughout the article, Mr. Hirschman indicated that he was speaking and had been on government missions. So I'm afraid that the very human problem of the Arab refugees, of the 1,500,000 Arab refugees, do exist, and Mr. Hirschman can't wipe them away with his arrogant and malicious false articles in any magazine.
I was intrigued from this article that he was referring to the Arab refugees as being used as political pawns in the Middle East struggle. Well, as an American here, I'd really be more concerned to the fact that Americans are being used as pawns for the Zionist cause by being asked to ignore the fact that millions of dollars are being sent from this country, which are tax deductible through the United Jewish Appeal to support a foreign government. Would you like to comment on this, Mr. Lilienthal?
Well, one thing one can say is that money is leaving this country to go to Israel through the United Jewish Appeal, much of which, as Mr. Avnari himself points out in his book, goes right into the Israeli treasury and is not used for humanitarian purposes, to pay salaries, to carry on wars of aggression, to do many things that are not related to human needs. And I think it would be well either for the United States government to look into the question of the tax exemptibility of the United Jewish Appeal, or to grant an equal status and equal support, which is more than the status, to a drive for a United Arab Appeal. As far as the question of political pawns, I think that there has been too much use of the Middle East as a political pawn, refugees and all. Many of the Arab leaders, unfortunately, play politics with the refugee problem, but we in the United States have done even more than that. Our political parties, today we see how they're vying for the local vote by playing politics with human misery and with the Middle East. And if we want any stability in the area, we've got to cease at once the continued subordination of policy to domestic politics. It is policy, justice, that must prevail in the area, and we must apply it, we as the great American people, rather than to subordinate it to the local exigencies of local, state, and national politicians.
Mr. Myasi, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you.
And God bless you.
Thank you. This is Night Calling New York. The Arabs live there, too. Our conversation tonight with Mr. Alfred Lilienthal calling in from New York. And out to Bloomington, Indiana, Mr. Williams is standing by. He's hearing Night Call over WFIU-FM. Mr. Williams, good evening.
Good evening. Mr. Lilienthal, I'm very curious as to why it is that when the situation seemed, well, in relative terms of the Middle East anyway, stable, why did Utant take the United Nations troops away from the from the ceasefire lines? I don't know that this necessarily precipitated the war effort that much, but it seemed at the very moment, or even before he actually did it, it seemed like an awfully silly thing to do, and it obviously resulted in not what very many people wanted. I never quite understood what his logic behind such a move was.
Well, he didn't have too much choice. Everyone agrees in retrospect. He probably acted not only too precipitately for his own interests, but for Arab interests too. I mean, they were only there so long as Egypt would allow these troops to be there. And when President Nasser notified the United Nations that he wished them to be withdrawn, Mr. U Thant could have delayed it. And maybe that delay might have saved the June war. Mr. Nasser certainly didn't think he was going to move that quickly. And Mr. U Thant even asked, before withdrawing his forces, asked the State of Israel whether they, who had never had UN troops stationed on their soil, whether they would take them. And the answer was a categorical negative. And so there, Mr. U Thant maybe panicked. He should have called perhaps a meeting of the General Assembly. I kind of think, from my study of the problem and from reading Ambassador Yost's very intelligent article in Foreign Affairs, that Cairo and the Arab world in general were stunned by the precipitate action of U Thant, but it's a legal question whether he ought to have moved as rapidly as he did. But that he had to, he had no sovereignty, sovereign rights to continue only so long as the Egyptian government, the United Arab Republic government, didn't request removal. As soon as they requested removal, he had to remove them.
I see. Well, I guess that's about
it. It's one of these many factors that if you read the tragic story of 1967, you see how nobody really wanted the war at that particular moment, least of all the Arabs. And yet everybody blundered and flustered right into it. There was one mistake compounded after another, and people failed to realize the mentality and the psychology of other people. For example, Nasser felt, I presume, that by rushing into a quick treaty with King Hussein in the few days before the war, that that would stem the tide and that Israel would not move. Actually, that was probably the straw that broke the camel's back.
Mr. Lilienthal, I'm sorry, I'll have to break in for station identification. Mr. Williams, thank you for calling.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. This is Night Call in New York, and tonight the Arabs live there too. Our guest tonight is Middle East expert Mr. Alfred Lilienthal, calling in from New York. We'll return to our guest right after station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Alfred Lilienthal after station identification. Next week on Night Call, the black vote, international racism, drug addiction, who should run the schools, and can Hollywood tell it like it is? Monday, Michigan Republican State Committee Chairman Earl Kennedy on black votes and white candidates. Tuesday, World Council of Churches head Eugene Carson Blake on is there an international Mason-Dixon line? Wednesday, ex-addict Arthur Donmeyer, has drug addiction become a substitute for freedom? Thursday, Rhody McCoy, storm center of the New York school controversy on unresolved crisis of decentralization. Friday, filmmaker Jules Dassin from Paris on his new production, Uptight, a remake of The Informer with a black cast. All this next week on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself. Collect from anywhere in the country to Alfred Lilienthal about the Middle East. Call Night Call Collect from the East and the Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And a welcome to the Night Call stations who join us for the second half hour each night. Tonight, our conversation, The Arabs Live There Too, and we are discussing the Middle East with the Middle East expert, Mr. Alfred Lilienthal. This time we'll go out to Colfax, California as we begin this half hour. Mr. Ratcliffe is hearing Night Call over KERS-FM. Mr. Ratcliffe?
Good evening.
Good evening, sir.
I have a question for Mr. Lilienthal.
Go ahead, sir.
Yes. In your introductory statement, you mentioned the increase of the Soviet sphere of influence in the Middle East. Later on, you mentioned a growing Arab nationalism. The question I have is, what is the relationship between the Soviet sphere of influence in the Middle East and Arab nationalism, or is it a pan-Arab nationalism?
Well, the relationship is that starting in 1951, first let's start with the partition of Palestine by the United Nations in November 1947. We must remember that it was the Soviet Union that voted with the United States and worked with the United States to partition Palestine and to set up the State of Israel. At this point, it seemed that the Soviet Union had reversed itself and was turning its back on Arab nationalism, the rival of Zionist Israeli nationalism. But they weren't, in fact. They waited 3 years, and then in 1951 abruptly broke off relations with Israel when they saw that they could make very little headway there and that their bread and butter rested on the Arab side. So from that time on, they have wooed by diplomacy, by giving arms, by giving every kind of help and support possible, the Arab world and Arab nationalism for their own personal selfish reasons. They have done it during the first Suez War of 1956 and again in 1967. Their influence as the Arab world became more anti-West has grown immeasurably. At first, the Soviet Union thought that they could set up their own political movements within the Arab world. But instead of setting their own communist parties up, which have been jailed by Arab leaders in most Arab countries, they have worked through encouraging Arab nationalism. And I maintained and said in a series of lectures during 67 and early 68 that it was not Israel that won the war and the Arabs that lost it, but it was the United States that won it and the Soviet Union, the United States that lost it and the Soviet Union that won it, because we see the aged fulfillment of the goal held alike by Peter and Catherine the Great and by Khrushchev and Kosygin, a Soviet movement into the Mediterranean, a daily enlarged Soviet naval presence in that sea, which was once called an American sea, and continued support given by arms and otherwise to the Arabs, and by psychological warfare in every direction, they have carried on a policy whereby they hoped that the Middle East would be divided up with the United States firmly on the side of Israel, and the Arab states having no place to go but to the Soviet Union. And in their defeat, the Arabs are more reliant on the Soviet Union, which makes one suspect whether the Soviet Union, in a way, didn't want the defeat of the Arab world.
But you see no actual political control besides the economic influence and the unpopularity of the U.S. in the Middle East due to this, then?
Well, there's no political influence at the moment, but should there be more instability and should powerful figures in the Arab world like Nasser and Hussein fall, who knows what can take place tomorrow. The Soviet influence would grow by leaps and bounds, even though the Arab world, and particularly the Islamic element in the Arab world, which is the overwhelming religion, of course, is basically anti-communist. But we have seen other parts of the world where there has been a definite anti-communist feeling, and yet the communist doctrinaire has come in and taken over in one guise or another, agrarian reform in China, for example, so that the strong theism of Islam may not be a strong bulwark if the West continues its policy of favoring Israel in every possible conflict. And when I say the West, I principally mean our country, the United States, which has taken such a strong and fervent one-sided position, not even recognizing that there is another side to the coin.
Mr. Lilienthal and Mr. Radcliffe, I know you're discussing the interest of where the Middle East is going to be politically or internationally, but I would like to introduce this, if I may. The refugee problem that seems to be a very critical one right now in the Middle East, what was the birth, or what were the circumstances, the conditions that gave birth to the refugee problem, and why is it such a telling problem right now?
Well, the problem is probably the most glaring human problem that we face in the field of refugees today. 1,500,000 refugees who have now faced two major exoduses. It came about when in 1947, the United Nations, under pressure from the United States and even from the Soviet Union, decided to partition the mandated territory, the UN mandate, which had succeeded the League of Nations, by giving two-thirds or 63% of Palestine to one-third of the population. And as a result, in the war that followed and in the resistance, the Arab refugees fled or were pushed out by the advancing army. In April, even before partition came into effect, that's April 1948, there was, on April the 10th, the tragedy of Deir Yassin, with 250 Arab women and children whose bodies were found in a well, and they were had been wiped out by one of the dissident armies of Israel, not the Haganah, but the Irgun Zvi'alumi. As a result, when word reached the second village, it was no longer 250. We know that the Arab has a love of exaggeration. We say a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. The Arab says a bird in the hand is better than 10 in the bush. So that when the 250 reached the next village, it was 2,500. And panic set in. And others left because of the advancing armies. There was a big, huge Arab population, which both the leaders of Zionism, when they wanted to set up the national home, just ignored. There are certain Arab, certain Zionist leaders who have said when they first came to Palestine before 1947, say around the time of the Balfour Declaration, they were surprised to know that there were only 7% a Jewish population, that 93% was either Christian or Muslim Arab. And so we had this tremendous Arab population who, as a result of the 1948 war, fled or were driven out and have been homeless since 1948. And to them, to this number, we must add the more than 200,000 who left in 1967 and who were pushed out. We have it on very reliable sources, and I think two parliamentarians, such as Ian Gilmore and Mr. Walters from the British Parliament and the House of Commons, after they visited the Middle East in early 1968, they said that the Arabs in the West Bank were being pushed out, that the bulk of refugees have been and are being forced out, even though today we can say that the rate of exodus has lessened. And there's all types of expert psychological warfare used in other instances. I've heard a story that residents of Bethlehem were informed that unless they left within hours, they and their homes would be blown up. They left. In another village, a rumor was spread, I think, that anyone remaining in the village 1 hour later would be killed. The entire populace evacuated their homes, and just by chance, they found buses outside their village to transport them across the river. And so it goes. In war, there is an undue amount of misery. But the thing is that the United States, which has opened its heart and soul to oppress people, to refugees all over the world, has turned its back on people whom they refuged by being the mainspring of support for the Zionist state of Israel. And this is the horrible fact that we must face today, and we face it not only on a humanitarian basis.
Mr. Lilienthal, we want to hold. We have Mr. Ratcliffe still on the line, and we've got some other calls coming. Mr. Ratcliffe, thank you for calling.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Alfred Lilienthal after station identification. Tomorrow night on Night Call. Teepees or tenements, not much choice for the American Indian, with Mrs. Fred Harris, the half-blooded Comanche wife of the junior senator from Oklahoma. This is like it is if you're an American Indian living on a reservation today. You're at the absolute bottom of the totem pole. You earn about $35 a week when you're working. Black people in Watts make almost twice that much. You die at age 43, 20 years before the rest of us, and a lot more often from suicide than the rest of us. Your children are nearly twice as liable to die during infancy, and your entire family suffers from the infectious diseases that modern sanitation and health habits conquered more than a generation ago. TP or Tenement with Mrs. Fred Harris, the half-blooded Comanche wife of the Oklahoma senator, tomorrow night on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself, collect from anywhere in the country to Alfred Lilienthal about the Middle East. Call Night Call Collect from the East and the Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-3357. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And we return to our guest, Mr. Alfred Lilienthal, calling in from New York, and this time we'll go out to Zanesville, Ohio. Mr. Schnee is hearing Night Call over WGY. Mr. Schnee?
Yes.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Your question?
Well, I've been listening to Mr. Lilienthal's expressions about the refugees and other aspects of the situation between the Israelis and the Arabs. And I would like to say that these refugees, in the beginning, left their homes voluntarily when Israel proclaimed its independence, and they forsook their Jewish fellow neighbors there and went over to the side of the attacking Arab nations, responding to their propaganda and so forth. And they fought against the Israelis on the side of the Arabs, expecting that they would speedily crush the fledgling state and return to their homes and perhaps have even more than they gave up. But it didn't work out that way. They are not refugees in the sense that they were driven or forced out. They left voluntarily and took part in the attack upon the Israelis. The Arabs who remained did not lose their homes. They were incorporated into the new nation. They have representatives in the Knesset, and they are citizens of Israel. Not a one of them was driven from their home. So now these Palestinian Arabs who went over to the attacking Arab nations in response to the urging or influence or propaganda of their fellow Arabs, when their project failed, it did not crush Israel, should not those Arab governments have absorbed them, provided for them a home and a livelihood, since these Palestinian Arabs cast their lot in with them in the attack? Instead of that...
Well, sir, what is the... I'm waiting for the question.
Well, I cannot agree with this presentation of Mr. Lilienthal of putting these refugees in a light that they should receive great sympathy as though they were driven out.
Well, Mr. Schnee, your viewpoint is entirely opposed to the United Nations viewpoint. Since 1948, there has been a resolution on the books, a resolution 194, chapter 3 of December 1948. It has been passed each successive General Assembly, which gives the Arab refugees the choice of returning home or being repatriated. And this option has never been accorded to them. Very few of them fought, very few of them had arms. And very few of them left their homes voluntarily. They were driven out, as Mr. Begin boasts about in his book, The Revolt. Many of them fled as a result of the Deir Yassin murder on April 1948. For whatever reason they left, their rights have been fully accorded by international justice, at least in lip service, in words, through the resolutions at each successive General Assembly. They have rights, these rights have been flouted until this resolution is implemented. This is what any type of universalistic, Judaistic justice would call for. You also mentioned the question of the Arabs who didn't flee and remained perfectly happy and content. Well, according to Norman Thomas, according to Uri Avnari, according to Mr. Childers, a British author of renown, the Arab refugees, the Arabs who live in Israel, are second-class citizens. Leaving aside the question of security reason at a time like this during a war, even before this, They were given restricted rights to move around Israel. They represent 12% of the population. They have 5% in the Knesset, the parliament. They hold no important office at a high echelon. There is discrimination against them in terms of jobs and positions. And all this can be verified by UN reports. So I don't think either the Arabs who remained in Israel nor the Arabs who fled have been given a deal in terms of the universalistic precepts, shall we say, of an Amos, the great prophet of Judaism, who said, "O ye are to me, O children of Israel, as are the Ethiopians." Were he alive today, he would say, "O ye are to me, O children of Israel, as are the Arab refugees." And we are not doing that for these people.
Well, I did not say that the Arabs who remained are happy and content. I will remind you that even in this country, there are many who feel that they are second-class citizens, they are discriminated against, and so forth. Do we not have a very similar situation? We must remember that the Arab nations will not make peace with Israel. They constantly threaten war. In fact, they are maintaining a state of war. There is no peace. And therefore, the Israelis are in a constant condition of having to be on guard, and they know that there are ties of sentiment and race between, well, and the nationhood of the Arabs, between those living in Israel and these threatening Arabs on every side. We could not expect that the Israelis would do otherwise than have to be very careful in the whole situation. But they have offered the Arab nations in a reasonable peace settlement that all of these questions would be considered. In fact, in Mr. Eban's address the other day, didn't he say that Israel stands prepared to return much of the West Bank and the Sinai Peninsula and so forth?
No, I don't think he spelled out what he meant. He just said that within the framework of peace, and I'm reading from the New York Times, the ceasefire lines will be replaced by permanent, secure, and recognized boundaries between Israel and each of the neighboring Arab states, and the disposition of forces will be carried out in full accordance with the boundaries under the final peace. We still have had no indication what Israel has in mind. And then further, in that same statement, he negates withdrawal from all Arab occupied territory by saying that, quote, "Israel does not seek to exercise unilateral jurisdiction in the holy places of Christianity and Islam in Jerusalem." In other words, they maintain their right to keep Jerusalem, but they will recognize some international trusteeship over the holy places.
Yes.
Mr. Schnee?
I mean, there's no indication as far as Jerusalem is concerned, definitely no.
Oh, yeah.
And as far as the other portions of occupied territory, there is no indication that Israel is willing to withdraw and come to some
Mr. Snay, thank you for calling, sir. Thank you so much. This is Night Call in New York, and this time we'll go out to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mr. Gatiss is hearing Night Call over KGGM. Mr. Gatiss?
Yes, this is Mr. Gatiss. Good evening.
Good evening, sir.
I would like Mr. Lailantol to please comment on the future of Jordan, particularly Ken Hussein, who has supported the policies of the United States in the Middle East for so many years, often imperiling his own position. And also, please, if he would comment on President Johnson's statement that he will guarantee all borders in the Middle East before the outbreak of hostilities in 1967.
Well, to take the second one first, we all heard Mr. Johnson, and particularly through our former ambassador to the United Nations, say, "We guarantee all the territory boundaries of all states of the Middle East." And we know that when the war broke out, this became an idle promise, and we moved to another situation. As to the future of King Hussein of Jordan, His Majesty, I think, once wrote a book, "Uneasy Lies the Head," a uneasy rests the crown or something to that effect, and he has a very, very difficult position of maintaining a loyalty to the West and still being part of the Arab world and realizing that while the United States hands out an arm or two to him now and then, the United States is the sponsor of the country which threatens Jordan and could unseat the king, namely Israel. If the situation continues much longer, both the king of Jordan and possibly other Arab leaders will be facing very, very difficult times and a threat to their continued regimes. Jordan has resisted all attempts on the part of the Soviet Union to supply arms, offers to substitute their arms for U.S. arms, and the United States is probably will stand or fall there, and we're making a tremendous struggle to hold on to Jordan, which is torn, but with the growing power of the resistance movement, it becomes a question of how long, torn as he is, the brave little king of Jordan can hold out.
Mr. Gatiss, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lilienthal, we have just about 30 seconds, and can you briefly, in 30 seconds, tell us whether or not that a Jewish state as we know it today will be able to remain in Israel?
A Zionist state of Israel will probably be able to remain for the foreseeable future of 10, 15, 20 years, but a Zionist state undeviating in its treatment of its Arab citizens and of Arabs outside cannot survive in a hostile world.
Mr. Lilienthal, thank you so much for being our guest tonight on Night Call. Tonight, The Arabs Live There was our conversation. Our guest from New York, Mr. Alfred Lilienthal. This is Del Shields in New York. Good night and peace.
Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tomorrow night, same time, same station, Mrs. Fred Harris, the Comanche wife of the junior senator from Oklahoma. Listen tomorrow night, discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, American Jewish Committee, and Urban Coalition.